And now in Of Life and Men, Howard Stableford uncovers the links between the Pulitzer Prize-winning American author John Steinbeck and a rock pool on the Californian coast.
If you look around our feet real closely, which is the trick in tide pooling, is to get down low and spend a little time just gazing, we see all kinds of living things right here. Trying to stay in the shade are little snails the size of a large garden pea, called a litterine or periwinkle.
Right, yes.
And here by my left foot is a little rock pool.
Yep, let's get down there.
A permanently wet pool. And we find other things living in the pool, like small black turban snails. They need a little more moisture than the periwinkles do.
Pulitzer Prize-winning American author John Steinbeck might well have gazed into this very rock pool on the coast of Monterey, California in the 1930s. As he watched the interplay of marine life in this intertidal pool, it occurred to him that human communities were connected in similar ways. Now, novelists find inspiration in many forms, but what was remarkable and little known about Steinbeck was that in his heart, he was a marine biologist. Allusions to his ecological thinking, the connections between man and nature, are peppered through many of his novels like East of Eden, The Grapes of Wrath, and Of Mice and Men. Although Steinbeck dabbled in marine biology courses as a student, it wasn't until he moved to the Monterey area of the Pacific coast that literary inspiration truly dawned. And it arrived in the unlikely form of a hard-working, hard-drinking, irascible and intelligent marine biologist named Ed Ricketts. This is the story of an extraordinary friendship that deeply influenced both their lives and work from the moment they met.
They were instantly attracted to one another. I think, you know, sort of a meeting of the minds or a kind of a soulmate.
Susan Schillinglaw is director of the Center for Steinbeck Studies at San Jose State University.
The relationship he had with Ricketts was perhaps the most intimate and most intense of his life. And that includes his wives. I think that Steinbeck writes again and again about the nature and the contours of friendship. All of his books have these male friendships in them. If you think Tom Joad and Casey in The Grapes of Wrath, or Lenny and George in Of Mice and Men, or Doc and the Boys in Cannery Row, they're all this kind of, you know, male bonding. And I think for Steinbeck that was a crucial relationship. He did have three wives. He enjoyed the company of women, but I think there was something intense and very necessary to him that friendship with other men gave him. And I think of all those, Ricketts was definitely the most intense relationship he had and probably the most important relationship. I qualify that some because I think his first wife was very important in shaping the kind of writer he was. But I think Ricketts shaped his ideas, and together they kind of, through dialogue and conversation, I think inspired one another.
And they not only inspired each other's ideas. Ricketts actually turns up in some of Steinbeck's novels.
Steinbeck often includes a Ricketts character in his texts, or a character roughly modeled on Ricketts. He certainly appears as something close to himself in a little short story called The Snake, in Cannery Row, in its sequel Sweet Thursday. But he's also the sort of wisdom character in many of the books. Casey in The Grapes of Wrath, he's slim and Of Mice and Men, he's Dr. Winter in The Moon is Down. He's the character who can always step back and see the whole and not become embroiled in all the agony and the frustration that many of the characters feel.
The real Ed Ricketts ran a small business collecting and selling biological specimens to schools and universities. He lived in his laboratory, squeezed between dozens of sardine canning factories on Monterey's Ocean View Avenue. The lab was the place to hang out for the local bohemian community of artists, writers, poets, as well as fishermen. The street and its inhabitants were later immortalized in Steinbeck's book Cannery Row. But Susan Schillinglaw explains how the book was further influenced by Ricketts' beliefs about ecology.
Its dominant metaphor is a tide pool, and he's looking at Cannery Row, which is a little enclave, a little community on the edge of the Pacific, and he's looking at all the people who live there as if they're specimens, as if they're creatures that he's kind of lifting out of this tide pool and looking at them and then looking at the connections among all these species. So you can see how if you take that metaphor of a scientist studying a tide pool and cataloging specimen and a writer saying, I can take a human community and look at them as a tide pool. That's kind of what he's doing in that book.
We don't have to go far to start seeing additional kinds of critters.
Let's move on down then towards the waterline, clamber over the boulders.
Notice here everything is bigger and now there's more diversity of critters. The black turban snails are the size of a good-sized marble. And when those are eaten by a crab or a starfish, then a hermit crab moves into them.
And that's what I just picked one out, I think. There's a little hermit crab in here.
Yes. So the turban snails that are moving quickly are doing that because they have a hermit crab in them.
Cannery Row in Monterey in California is a poem, a stink, a grating noise, a quality of light, a tone, a habit, a nostalgia, a dream. Its inhabitants are, as the man once said, whores, pimps, gamblers, and sons of bitches, by which he meant everybody. Had the man looked through another peephole, he might have said saints and angels and martyrs and holy men, and he would have meant the same thing.
Cannery Row still stands today. The canneries have long since closed down, so it remains as a tourist attraction for Steinbeck fans. And there, I met up with local historian Michael Hemp, who gave me a guided tour.
Cannery Row in the 1930s and 40s was the Street of the Sardine, where 16 to 20 canneries and reduction plants that accounted for the fish meal and fertilizer, for which we really provided the world, were shoulder to shoulder here in a canyon of sardine factories.
Why here, though? Why in this particular place?
Because Monterey Bay provided what at the time seemed an unending natural resource. For half a year, there were so many fish, so many sardines in this bay that they could be captured very easily, initially right offshore. And even into the 30s and 40s, seasons here of over 200,000 tons in a six-month season were not uncommon at all.
What was life like here? Was it a tough existence
for
people
working in the industry? Oh, it certainly was. It certainly was. The boats came in, emptied their fish into the buckets and the hoppers that took them into the canneries and started the cooking and the canning process. And this is America, still in the Industrial Revolution, really. There were no unions until the late 1930s, and here in Monterey, the lady stated the packing lines, and everybody was at work as long as it took to can that day's catch. And if it was 6 hours, it was 6 hours. If it was 18 hours, it was 18 hours.
Was Steinbeck attracted then by the place, by the smell, the people, or by Ed Ricketts?
I'd say he was probably captivated by all of it, especially the denizens of Cannery Row, because he wasn't required, nor did he write about the canneries or even the cannery workers. He was more interested in the personalities and the life that went on in the microcosm of the people who lived on the fringes here, the bums, the whores, the madams, the scientists, the neighbors, the artists, pretty ordinary people. Another feature of John Steinbeck's writing, he rarely wrote about anybody of what you would normally consider significance.
Right.
He was writing about every man.
Do you know what's also fascinating about Cannery Row is, although we've said it's all very garish and tourist shops and restaurants and things, if you half close your eyes, you can still get a sense of what it might have been like. In fact, where we're standing now, if we look across the street, there are some buildings that, they're talked about and appear in the novel.
They are actually in the novel, yes.
What can we see?
Well, John didn't write much fiction. He wrote about real people and real places. So we're looking at the Wing Chong Market, which is chapter one of John Steinbeck's Cannery Row. It's the Chinese grocery, the miracle of supply. And next to it is the La Ida Cafe, one of the two bordellos that makes John's book.
Lee Chong's grocery, while not a model of neatness, was a miracle of supply. It was small and crowded, but within its single room, a man could find everything he needed to be happy. Clothes, food, liquor, tobacco, fishing equipment, machinery, boats, cordage, caps, pork chops. You could work out combinations to fit almost any mood.
Well, we've pretty much walked the length of Cannery Row, and we're standing outside a very unassuming brown wooden plank building. There's a row of windows up there, a wooden staircase up to a door halfway up the building, and no signs, no signposts to indicate what this is. And yet, actually, this is one of the most famous landmarks of the whole Cannery Row.
Yes, it is. This is Ed Ricketts' lab.
You've got to know it's here because there are no signs. Why are there no signs? Is it on purpose?
Yes. Over the years, they quit putting up the 800-800. The numbers that they would put up on the lab would be purloined by Ricketsophiles and Steinbeck fans who wanted to take something of Ed Ricketts' lab home with them.
Well, I tell you, all the tourists are walking straight past this building, but we know it's here, so let's go inside.
Western Biological deals in strange and beautiful wares. It sells the lovely animals of the sea, the sponges, tunicates, anemones, the bivalves, barnacles, the worms and shells, nudibranchs and tectibranchs, the spiked and knobbed and needly urchins, the snapping shrimps, and ghost shrimps so transparent that they hardly throw a shadow. These are all for sale. You can order anything living from Western Biological, and sooner or later you will get it.
Wow. It's wooden inside as well.
Yes, very, very basic.
Wooden floor, wooden walls and ceiling, about, what, 20 feet long, 15 feet wide. And here's a photo of Ed Ricketts on the wall here and a bookshelf behind.
Pretty much, so the structure is original. Some of the furnishings are not any longer. But one of the originals that I'm very proud to introduce you to is Frank Wright, who
is among the
lab members who have been part of this fantastic landmark. And Frank has the distinction of being one of the two gentlemen in this lab group that actually knew Ed during World War II.
Great to meet you, Frank.
Thank you very much.
What was your first impression of him? What did you know about him?
Well, I didn't know that he was a marine biologist when I first met him. I came in here and wondered what he was doing living in a place that had a sign out in front that said Pacific Biological Laboratories. And I asked him, I said, are you interested in marine biology or something? He said, yes, that's what I am. I'm a marine biologist.
Doc is the owner and operator of the Western Biological Laboratory. Doc is rather small, deceptively small, for he is wiry and very strong, and when passionate anger comes on him, he can be very fierce. He wears a beard, and his face is half Christ and half satyr, and his face tells the truth. Doc has the hands of a brain surgeon and a cool, warm mind. Doc tips his hat to dogs as he drives by, and the dogs look up and smile at him.
Frank Wright gained an insight into what Ed thought about his life being the center of what was to become a hugely successful novel.
One day I came in 1944, and there was a cardboard box. And it was sitting on the table, and it said on the cover, Cannery Row, a novel by John Steinbeck. It was the manuscript for Cannery Row. And I said, Ed, what is this? He said, oh, my God, I didn't want you to see that. I said, well, why not? He said, well, we don't want any advance publicity. John has asked that this be kept very confidential.
Did you turn the pages? Did you have a steep?
No, he wouldn't let me look at it.
Is that right?
I just saw the cover, but I said, well, what's it about? Well, he said, what do you think it's about? It's all about me.
It's interesting that he said it was all about him. That's very important. Did he like it? Did he like
loved
it?
He loved it.
It wasn't just Ricketts that appeared in Cannery Row. The Pacific Ocean and the animals that he collected and studied there also starred in the book.
Doc was collecting marine animals at the Great Tide Pool on the tip of the peninsula. It is a fabulous place. When the tide is in, a wave-churned basin, creamy with foam, whipped by combers that roll in. But when the tide goes out, the little water world becomes quiet and lovely. The sea is very clear, and the bottom becomes fantastic, with hurrying, fighting, feeding, breeding animals.
It is a beautifully still and sunny morning here on the Pacific coast of California. We're just about 2 miles south of Cannery Row on the rock pools here on the coastline. There are gulls basking in the sun over here. You might hear the call of a black oyster catcher. And with me is Steve Webster, who's a senior marine biologist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We are looking actually, Steve, aren't we, at the Great Tide Pool, as mentioned in Cannery Row. Just describe for me, would you, what the Great Tide Pool is. How big is it? How does it work?
The Great Tide Pool must be pretty close to half an acre. And it's just a little embayment in the rocks that at a low tide is completely cut off from the rest of the Pacific Ocean. That really is the definition of a tide pool, like this one right over here to our left. On this tide level, that water is trapped there higher than where sea level is at the moment. It will become awash with the ocean in a couple of hours when the water returns to that level.
And why is a tide pool particularly interesting to marine biologists?
I think tide pools are of great interest, one, because they are nature's aquaria, if you will, and two, because they're accessible. It's a place that you can go to observe firsthand marine organisms without having to be a scuba diver or without having to get into a submarine.
Well, the culmination of Ed Rickett's work was Between Pacific Tides, and I've got a copy of it here, which he published the same year as Steinbeck published The Grapes of Wrath, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Just how important was this work?
That work was a landmark work in its day, and it's still very important. Every student of marine biology along this coast owns a copy of that book. And it was a landmark book in that it took an ecological kind of holistic approach to the intertidal communities rather than a descriptive one species at a time kind of approach. Ed was really interested in the processes, in the interactions of the plants and animals with each other, with the environment. If he were standing here, he would be asking, why is that group of limpets there instead of over there? Or why is it at this level of the intertidal instead of higher or lower? What is it that structures these communities? Those were the kinds of questions that really fascinated him. And he was 20 or 30 years ahead of his time in asking those sorts of questions.
And do you think there's an influence that John Steinbeck might have had on his interpretations, on the way that he thought about these groupings and how everything is interconnected?
Steinbeck was interested in people and their interactions and their politics and how they were interconnected. And I think the two of them kind of cross-fertilized in placing man in nature and at the same time asking the questions, okay, are some of the ways people behave singly and in groups at all similar to the way some of these species behave singly and in groups? And definitely the Ricketts and Steinbeck philosophies intersected in many ways in asking those kinds of questions.
The biggest project they undertook together was a trip to the Sea of Cortez, a 4,000-mile voyage to survey and collect animals that lived in the intertidal zone around the Baja California Peninsula. Afterwards, they wrote a book together detailing their adventures. Called The Sea of Cortez, it comprised two parts: the log, a humorous account of the trip mostly written by Steinbeck, and an appendix containing all the scientific data, which was mostly Rickett's work. This collaboration marked the height of their friendship and influence on each other, a visible testament to their deep mutual respect. Steve Webster explained to me why Ricketts and Steinbeck chose to go to the Sea of Cortez in the first place.
I think the allure of it, Howard, is that if you look at a map, no biologist could help but want to go and see what's going on there. You would realize it's almost tropical at the tip of the Baja California Peninsula, and then it must get quite chilly, at least in the winter, at the head of the Gulf, and indeed quite hot in the summer, almost unbearably hot. Must be a fascinating place biologically. And the two of them went right before World War II. They chartered a fishing boat here in Monterey was a six-week expedition to collect. They took lots of beer. They took Carol Steinbeck, John's wife, although you don't learn that reading the book.
She's never mentioned, is she?
No, and it was at her request that she was left out, because it turns out they were on the verge of getting a divorce. Hmm. And why she even elected to go is a good question. Apparently she kept herself locked in her cabin a good deal of the time, did not have a good time. John and Ed had a wonderful time. And a lot of good science came out of it. They collected about 600 specimens on that trip, many of them new to science. And the book is a wonderful book. The critics didn't know what to do with it. It was so different from anything else Steinbeck had written. I think they published it out of courtesy more than anything else.
I can understand why a marine biologist would go, but what on earth was in it for John Steinbeck?
Steinbeck had just published Grapes of Wrath. There had been a huge clamor about it from the media, from the people in the Salinas Valley who took him to task for exposing their foibles and their prejudices, and he needed a rest from that. Steinbeck is even quoted as saying something to the effect, "I've worked the novel as far as I can. I need to do something different. I'm going to become a scientist for a while." And he actually read a lot of science before they went on that trip. And when introduced to someone at a party who didn't know him, he sometimes introduced himself as a sort of marine biologist.
I sat on the veranda of Ed Rickett's lab with Katie Roger, a former Steinbeck fellow at San Jose State University, and I asked her whether Steinbeck really did consider himself a marine biologist.
Steinbeck was really interested in and a part of Ed's business in the lab. He was a silent partner in the lab, which a lot of people don't know, but also that they really were able to talk on a deep and professional level about the science that they did together during the Sea of Cortez trip, and also that Ed was continually doing through the lab itself.
So there was a concerted effort by Steinbeck to become a respected marine biologist.
I think it's important to remember that Steinbeck, even before he met Ed, was interested in marine biology, had studied some marine biology, and also, you know, had what, you know, we would call a kind of an ecological perspective himself before, you know, the two ever got together in 1930. Steinbeck was tremendously excited to be able to learn what Ed could teach him about the hands-on collecting and cataloging and note-taking. Likewise, Ed wanted to sit with Steinbeck and watch how the ideas could be put down and articulated better. And this really was going to be an attempt for Steinbeck to leave behind fiction writing and start a life as a marine biologist. Granted, it was short-lived. I mean, he did return soon after the expedition to really what his true calling was, which was to write prose, fiction in particular. But, you know, that should not detract from the significance and earnestness with which he really embarked on all of this.
The exposed rocks had looked rich with life under the lowering tide, but they were more than that. They were ferocious with life. There was an exuberant fierceness in the littoral here, a vital competition for existence. The animals, rather than deserting such beaten shores for the safe cove and protected pools, simply increase their toughness and fight back at the sea with a kind of joyful survival.
When you read this stuff, it's easy to see the influences that Steinbeck got from Ed Ricketts and his work. What about the other way around? What did Ed Ricketts get from John Steinbeck?
Ed really admired, I mean truly admired, much the way he admired good music and good art, good writing. John's writing was just metaphysical almost for him, that he had the ability to express ideas so clearly and beautifully. In addition to that, I think he saw in John a keen eye, a good observer, someone who was able to represent people and situations in an admirable way.
I like that relationship too, because a scientist has to be an extremely good observer of nature,
right.
And a writer, in turn, in John Steinbeck's case, is a very good observer of human beings.
Right. Yeah, I think that the whole book, The Sea of Cortez, is significant because it wasn't just a travel narrative, it wasn't just a scientific expedition, but it was really a trip out to see what they could see, as they put it in their introduction. And this differed from kind of anything that had come before.
One of the reasons that the log from the Sea of Cortez and Rickett's Between Pacific Tides were both groundbreaking books was Rickett's approach. He developed a philosophy which he called non-teleological thinking, a different way of looking at things. Susan Schillinglaw again.
Non-teleological thinking, which is somewhat an unfortunate term because people think, what does that mean? You know, teleology is looking to the end, looking to the end result, the causes, etc. Rickett's basically, it was his term, and he basically said to look at things non-teleologically is not to worry about the end results, the causes, the effects, but simply to look at something as it is and to focus on what you see and have a kind of acceptance of what exists.
This non-teleological thinking determined the way in which Ed Ricketts approached biology, and it really came to the fore in the Sea of Cortez book. It wasn't just a catalogue of species found at each place, but an attempt to see the ecological picture as a whole. Susan Schillinglaw explains.
The first pages of that, Steinbeck talks about how do we know truth? Or how do we know a truth about a fish, about a species? Well, we can certainly look at it under the microscope or in a tray in a scientific lab, and there is the fish. And we can say, well, this is the truth about it. We can look at its skeletal systems, the properties of the fish, etc. But is that really the truth of the fish? The truth of the fish is when it's in the water, leaping, swimming, eating, whatever it does. So what he says is we're going to try to blend those two so that, you know, life, experience, cataloging are all part of the picture. But certainly the whole picture cannot be that simply of what he calls the dryball scientists who want a catalog, who want to list properties of a species without seeing it as a part of life, how it relates to other species, what its habitat is like. You know, basically the study of ecology, which was a relatively new term in the 30s, and they both wanted to see an ecological whole.
Ed Ricketts was killed suddenly, aged 48, when a freight train leaving Cannery Row slammed into his car as he crossed the tracks. Ed's death so upset Steinbeck that many say he never fully recovered. In that freak accident, he lost his spiritual twin. Although to the outside world they seem to deal in vastly different subjects, one a scientist, the other a writer, in fact they engaged with the world from the same perspective, combining arts and sciences together, living in a symbiosis as ecologists.
Our own interest lay in the relationships of animal to animal. If one observes in this relational sense, it seems apparent that species are only commas in a sentence, that each species is at once the point and the base of a pyramid. One merges into another. Groups melt into ecological groups until the time when what we know as life meets and enters what we think of as non-life. Barnacle and rock, rock and earth and tree, tree and rain and air. And the units nestle into the whole and are inseparable from it. It is advisable to look from the tide pool to the stars, and then back to the tide pool again.
Of Life and Men was presented by Howard Stableford. The reader was George Fazoco, and the programme was produced in Bristol by Joanne Stevens.